just before the outbreak of war, I was in hospital, suffering from scarlet fever and complications, and I was discharged hospital on Saturday, the 2nd of August, 1914, and with a recommendation for 2 weeks sick leave, followed by 2 weeks annual leave, and with also a warning that I should go to the seaside for my sick leave to recuperate because I had a very bad complication. So my mother arranged for me to go to Margate, where we used to go. So on Sunday the 3rd of August, of course I went to Margate, and there was mobilisation, and I found also, through communication with my bosses, that we had to be given permission by our hospital service, the Metropolitan Assistance Board, to join up in order that we should get priority for replacements. Well, my immediate senior was in the territorials of the yeomanry, and he was called up. And my next colleague applied for permission to join. So I had to wait for a while. And then I heard that experienced replacements were very hard to get. So I volunteered to forego my annual leave and come back and help until things cleared up a bit. Well, my second in command, my second colleague, applied, and he didn't pass because of eyesight. While I was at Margate, I received 2 white feathers. I was only a chitch, and I only weighed 7, 7, 8 pounds. Eventually, I returned, and I didn't get my permission to join up till late in September. So, I went home to Ham, and I applied at Kingston Barracks Regular Army, to join up in Kitchener's Army. The recruiting sergeant told me, "Kitchener wants men. He won't take you, you know, son. You're too much of a titch. Try the territorials at the other end of Kingston." So off I went to the territorials. And by very great fortune or providence, at the drill hall, the recruiting officer for that night was Captain Marston, who was my old captain in the cadet corps at the county school. Now, I must give you the perspective of that because it's rather important. I was senior corporal in the cadet corps. I got a medal for shooting, and myself and another, trained as a Boy Scout, fixed up a signalling section. So he knew what my experience was. Well, my chest measurement was 34 1/4, and they wanted the 35. But the captain said, "Pass him, I know him well, he'll grow." So that was that. Much to Mum and Auntie Ada's very sad surprise. Now, this was the 2nd 6th East Surrey Nucleus. The 1st 6th East Surrey, on mobilisation, they were in summer camp, and they were posted to Canterbury, and there the whole of the Home Counties Division of Territorials had been sent. And there they were intended to go to, first of all, to Antwerp. But Kitchener decided otherwise. He said they weren't experienced enough, and he wanted them to replace regulars in India. So that was that. So the second sixth nucleus were only about 100 of us, and the captain, knowing my experience, put me number one in the line, and we used to do drill at Fairfield, at Kingston. We used to do route marches through Ham to Richmond Park and round, and when we marched through Ham, they used to wave at us. Now the uniforms, khaki was absolutely unobtainable at that time. We had the church parade green uniform of the old first six in Surrey's. We looked very smart in it. Well, after a while, we did a lot of drilling. We hadn't got rifles, but we learned a lot from some of the old first six who had remained behind to teach us. I was put in charge of the miniature rifle range recruits, and I taught them how to fire a rifle, because when I was in the cadet corps, we used to fire at the service range at the East of Common, and I was showing them which end to put the bullet in and how to score the on the miniature range. Well, then a sudden change came. The first 60 Surreys had 30 medical rejects, and the colonel came down to us to select 30 replacements. He lined us all up, and he wanted those who had previous military experience. He goes down the line, he looked at me, he said, "I know you. When did I see you last?" I said, "In the County School Cadets at your summer camp." Go over there. So that was mine. That was that. So, from being in the second six, top 50, one might say, I became a recruit at Canterbury. I was given my travelling voucher, and I was sent to Canterbury. And there we were billeted for a while, and issued with long Lee Metford rifles, and we did a lot of hard drill. And of course, I met some of my old pals from school there too, in my company, C Company. Well, eventually, we were reviewed by King George V and Queen Mary, the whole of the Home Counties Division. And then we were sent abroad. On the 29th of October, we were sent to Southampton. And our battalion was put on the troop ship Grand Tully Castle, which was 10,000 tons. And after midnight on the 29th to the 30th of October, we set sail. On the morning of the 30th, the whole of the convoy was off Cherbourg, and the crucial battle of Ypres was being fought in France. And if the Germans had broken through, we, the territorials, called England's last hope, were going to be landed at Cherbourg. But we stuck there for a couple of days, perhaps until the 1st of November, or anyhow, until the 31st of October, and then went on. And on the 1st of November, on the second, no, the third, I think it was, we were arrived at Malta. And in Malta, Valletta, the harbour was full of French gunboats. Still, they made room for us, and we all were whole of the convoy. 13 ships were all crammed into Valletta Harbour. Of course, any of us who had a bit of money was spending it on silly things like Maltese cigarettes, things like that, terrible things. Anyhow, we sat there for a couple of days, and then suddenly the situation changed. Turkey declared war on the 5th of November. Now, the two German cruisers, Goeben and Breslau, had been interned at Istanbul. It wasn't called Istanbul then, at the outbreak of war. But Turkey declaring in their favour, they were released. Therefore, they were a menace to us going across the Mediterranean. So at midnight on the 5th of October, we zigzagged across the Mediterranean and arrived safely at Alexandria. And there we had a spate of coaling. And while the coaling was going on, we showed the flag. We all marched through Alexandria, and all praised by the populace of all sorts, and given presents, and really made a fuss of in Alexandria. Then off we went to Port Said, and from Port Said we started to go through the canal. When we got about halfway through, in the Bittern Lakes, we passed a convoy coming up, and those were our regular army sections that we were replacing. And they passed us quite close, about 10 yards away, and we were not in khaki, we were in a blue serge uniform that had been issued to us temporarily. And they stared at us. "Who are you?" We told them. "Where are you going?" "India, you silly so-and-sos. You're going the wrong way." Well, we often wondered afterwards who was going the wrong way, because I don't think any of them survived, you know. Well, then we had to stick at Port Said, no, at Suez. We had to stick at Suez for quite a while, because the German cruiser Emden was in the Indian Ocean raiding convoys of commerce, sinking them 2 or 3 a day. And in the meantime, an Australian convoy was coming up to take over in Egypt. And the Australian convoy and their escort, His Majesty's Australian ship Sydney, were halted, and the Sydney went out to scrap the Emden. They sunk the Emden at Cocos Island, and then went to Aden. When we arrived at Aden, there they were, these Australians, all in their boats, all round us, cheering like mad, and the Sydney was a four-funnel cruiser with the collision mats all along the side, barbettes stuck up that way, a hole through the funnel. We thought, well, if that's the Sydney, God help the Emden. Well then, we arrived in India, at Bombay, on the 3rd of October. Sorry, 3rd of December. And proceeded to our first station, Faizabad. Now, Faizabad is in central India, in the Oud province, and we were greeted there by the Indians in a very different way from what we expected. The rumors from the regulars that the territorials were Rajah Sabs. We were all rich men. Therefore, they were looking about to exploit us in the bazaars. But, unfortunately, we had no pay. We had no pay on board ship from October to December. We were all spent out. We used to play bingo. It used to be called housey-housey. Not for money, but for cigarettes. We were so hard up. And we were so hard up for the first two or three weeks that the officers clubbed together and gave us a meagre allowance of about 2 rupees each per week. That's about 2 and 8 pence. And we were dished out in khaki uniform. We were dished out with modern, regular rifles, the Enfields, which were issued to us from Rawalpindi Arsenal. We were really fitted out and felt rather proud of ourselves. And then we had to start to work because the situation, the political situation was this. The danger was the Northwest Frontier border tribes who were Afghan tribes, bloodthirsty, pinching rifles, raiding the crops, and were a menace to the Punjab. And there were two divisions guarding the frontier. The Northwest Frontier Division number 1 and number 2. Number 1 was stationed at Peshawar and onward to the Khyber Pass. Number 2 was stationed at Rawalpindi on towards Peshawar. The boundary was the River Indus with the strategic railway footbridge at Attock across the Indus. Number 1 was very, very advanced regulars. Number 2 also. Now, number 2 had 2 regular battalions left, a lot of Indian battalions, and a troop of mountain battery armor pay. Well, we had to now practice for what is called Kitchener's Test. Kitchener's Test is done every year in India to ascertain which battalions were fit for a number 1 and 2 divisions. It comprised a lot of field firing, a lot of firing classification. It depended on statistics on sickness and statistics on the scoring of the classification, and a lot of tests to find which were the fittest troops to man number 1 division and number 2 division. So at Faizabad we started that, and we had classification for rifle firing. I passed first class in that. Then we went through Kitchener's Test, and it was a very arduous test. We had to march 15 miles loaded with our packs and 100 rounds of live ammunition. We had to advance over unknown scrub territory towards metal firing plates which represented the enemy in sectional rushes and firing at these plates, and we had to get 3% hits to pass that part of the test. It was a very strenuous job. Well, we passed it. And to our elation, because we were a very enthusiastic crowd, we were promoted from Faizabad to number 2 division, stationed at Rawalpindi. At Rawalpindi, we were stationed on the north side of the city, and over on that side we could see all the hills. We could see the Hindu Kush, and immediately in front of us the foothills, Murray Hills, Kundana Hills. Murray Hills were where all the elite went in the summertime, and there was a signal tower on Murray Hills. The regulars that we had to meet up with were the 2nd North Staffords and the 1st Yorkshires, and the Mountain Battery, and 3 or 4 battalions of Indians. And we had to work with them to qualify as a very effective second line of defense to be pushed forward if there was any trouble over the Peshawar way. But there was very severe rivalry amongst the 2 regulars. The 1st Yorks had the second chance in sick leave, and they were nicknamed the Peaceful Yorks. The 2nd, the Staffs, they were the 1st battalion to go forward, and they regarded themselves as superior. So every year, the 2nd Staffs went up to the hills in the summertime, and this year, the first year, 1915, we went up to the hills, and it was a 3-day trek up to the hills, and we went up with camel transport, everything packed on camels, and I was one of the escort going up with them, a 3-day trek. And we were stationed at a place called Kundana. Now Kundana is 8,000 feet above sea level. Admittedly, Rawalpindi is 1,000 feet. Just beside it is Murray Hill, 8,500 feet. And we were on Kundana, and the road going between, going on toward Kanspur, and going on towards Kashmir. There was a milestone outside to Srinagar, 46 miles, and on that milestone was carved R.I.P. Peaceful Yorks. We know who wrote that on, the Staffs. Well, that first summer we were at Kundana, and we had a very interesting time up there, and we started hobbies. Well, when we were at Faizabad, I started a hobby. Shall I talk about it? My hobby was photography. About 10 or 12 of us bought cameras. My first camera was a Brownie box camera, and there was a photographer, a tradesman at Faizabad, who used to print for us. It was Tone and Fix. We used to buy big sheets of toning paper. We used to cut them up to the size of our film, and we had printing frames from him. We took our pictures, we printed them by sunlight, we took them down to him, and he toned and fixed them for us, and we put a little derby mark, a little trademark, on each chap's, put a little trademark on the back of his pictures. My trademark was a circle and a cross. Still, that was my trademark. And then we used to sell these to our colleagues and anybody who wanted them. They cost us eightpence a dozen, eight annas a dozen to have them toned and fixed. And of course we had to pay for the paper. And really, at three annas per copy, we made one anna profit per copy. And that, of course, helped us with our meagre money. Well, eventually our credit advisor had come through, and of course we were very interested in the bargaining, so we won't talk about that, in the bazaars. Well, then, let me see. Then we returned to Walpenny from the hills and went on guards. Oh, the guards we did. The guards in the cantonment and the guards at the Walpenny Arsenal, rampart guards, magazine guards, and all that sort of thing. It was very interesting, but humdrum. And I got fed up with bedewing guards, and they wanted one or two others in the signal section. Well, as I told you, I knew a bit about signals, so I applied to join the signal section, and I did. Then we swatted up flags, lamps, helio, and large flags, small flags, map reading, table laying, and all that in helio, in signalling. And then we had to go through a classification test passed by the signalling officer of the 2nd North Staffords. And we went through the test, practical and theoretical, and I got first class signaller there. Well then, everybody started to get fed up. You know, it was humdrum out there. We'd got to Walpenny and we were there doing our drills and guards and everything. And whenever there was a job going anywhere, everybody applied for them. Then something changed. In 1916, out in Mespot, Cott capitulated. General Townsend and the whole of his force capitulated. And the situation was terrible. They sent troops out from Blighty, and they sent troops out from India. Volunteers were wanted to join other battalions who had a sick list, and 30 of our men went to the 1st, 4th Somersets, and they went out to Basra. And then they applied for signalers to join signal sections at Pune. Of course, I prompted for that, and I got it. As I'd passed pretty good in the test, I was sent with six of us, were sent to Pune for intensive training. There we found we were attached RE signals. Now RE rates of pay are different from ours. They're a little better than ours. They start at 6th rate at the bottom, cable laying, and they go on to 3rd rate for rank and file, skilled rate, and second rate and first rate for instructors. Well, at Pune we went to an intense training school. We had to pass out in circuits, telephone circuits, 14 telephone circuits. We had to pass out more intensively in visual signalling and more intensively in rate playing, or if in rate sending, more, or if our bent was only cable laying, we were put on cable laying squads at 6 rate. Well, of course, I was in the sending section, because I was a first class signaller, and we punched up our rates, we punched up our circuits, we punched up our theory, and I was promoted to 5th rate, which was a good bit more than what I was getting in the battalion. Unfortunately, at home, I had to inform them, and they deducted it from my pay at home, but still, we had to do that. Then, some of us, were sent out to Basra to form a signal company, RE's, to be attached to a division or a brigade. And at Basra, we were all lined up, and the captain came along and said, "What could you do? What could you do? What could you do? What could you do?" And most of us said, "All of it, all of it, all of it." And those who were only second class signalers, well, we put them aside for the cable laying squad. Now, a signal section isn't only just signalers. There's mule section with mule carts for transport. And there's riding sections, cavalry sections, which was run by a corporal of the 21st Lancers, detailed out with us. And then there was the signalers who were good at sending and receiving Morse code at their rates. The time I went out, I could read about 18 words a minute. By the time I punched up later on, I could read 26 words a minute, but I could only write down 24s. So, eventually, they put me on the 4th rate, which was a lot more money still. Then, the corporal in charge in the office, Corporal Remnant, who used to be a bowler in the Hampshire cricket team, went out for a commission. So temporarily, they put me in the office. And I was the last corporal unpaid. Well then, I was in the office for quite a while. And I enjoyed it. But then, to sort of keep in touch, I had to do an hour a day punching up my rates, and in the evening from the office of the, from the roof of the office, a mile and a half away from the camp, I used to send lamps to a squad of recruiters who were sent out to us. And that was very interesting too. And instead of building up outstations, it took a lot of the trained people away from headquarters. So it was considered that I would have to return to duty eventually. But then suddenly, we were told that we no longer were the Nazareth Front Signal Company, because at the recapture of Kot, which occurred while we were at the base, the whole situation had changed, and the Turks, who drew a line across from the Euphrates to the Tigris at Kot, had gone up, and we were now number two lines of communication signal company, which had to preserve the line of the irrigation canal, where a lot of in the area of the irrigation area where a lot of produce was produced, and we had to protect the line of supply up the Euphrates. So we were no longer required at Nazaria. We went back to base to refit, and we went up the Tigris by paddle boat. Now a paddle boat has a barge on each left on each side of it, because the Tigris is very, very bendy, and it served a double purpose. There were supplies on the barges, there were horses and mules on the barges, and they served as collision mats, as one might say, when we stranded on the bends. And very interesting, because there were little villages on the bends, and women used to come out, and as we stranded on the bend, they would come out and sell us eggs and chickens. And then when we stranded on the next bend, they'd run the same women or the same village and start selling us stuff there. Anyhow, we gradually got our way up to Cotalamara, and we halted at Cotalamara for about a day, and had more supplies put on, and then worked our way up to Baghdad. Now, when we passed Cotalamara about 2 hours, a pal of mine and I were idly looking over the side, and we saw a city in front of us. Now, we knew Cotalamara was behind us, but it looked like Cotalamara. So we both looked at it, and we said, "That's Kot." And as we looked at it, it went. And we looked at each other, bloody mirage. It was the most wonderful mirage I've ever seen. I've seen mirages of lakes and all that before, but to see the whole city of Kot in mirage was fantastic. And then we got to Baghdad, and on the west bank of Baghdad, and there was a big camp called Hinaidi, and we went there, and we settled there for a while, unloading our stores and everything, and we were destined to go back to the Euphrates by road, 62 miles, and be stationed at Thilla, which is much further north than Nazaria. Now, the captain went ahead of us, and I was in the office, and I had charge of the office records and some of the signaling equipment, fortunately, in one Ford car with the officer's batman as my escort, and a Burmese driver, and we went ahead of the section. They had to march. It took them 3 days to march 62 miles, but we went ahead by car, and the telegraph line was on the horizon by the road, half a mile on the way. Well, about 20 miles on the Baghdad side of Hilla, our car seized up. Now, Pooh, what were we going to do? These troops that we were, our section, was 2 days' march behind us. We were near the Attila, well, 20 miles away. So I got out some signalling equipment with my Batman escort, and we walked across to the telegraph line, and we swung a line across the telegraph line and called up Hilla, HLA. Well, they got our captain on the phone, on the line. So I told him what had happened. And he ticked me off. He said, get off the line, you're earthing the line from Baghdad to Hilla. But we were. So, anyhow, he was glad so we slept in the car that night, and a van came out from Hilla and took us there. Now, at Hilla, the big square Turkish fort, and all round are the living quarters and upstairs as well. And we were in there with the signal office there. And of course, my office was there as well. But then we started feeding out lines, outpost lines, and we were rather scarce of skilled operators to 30 siege lines, effectively. So, I was returned to duty. I passed fourth rate, therefore I was returned to duty. I was more valuable as a signaller than as a clerk. And they put me in charge with one only British rank of a place called Hindia Barrage. And you see what? Hindia Barrage is a junction of the Euphrates and two canals, and it is a weir. That's why it's called a barrage. It's a weir. And we were in charge there. And we had to send a circuit diagram back to headquarters to show that we understood the connections. Every chap who went to an outstation in charge had to send a circuit diagram back. Well, I sent my circuit diagram back, and that was okay. I had under me two Indian orderlies from the local battalion during the day, and two others at night time. One to just take charge in case anything came through and then wake us up, and one as a messenger if there was anything. We had to provide our own cooking arrangements, very primitive, and we had to draw our stores at Hilla Dump. All the waste I saw at that dump. McConaughey's blowing up in the heat, and we couldn't have one of them. We were on bully beef and dried up bacon, and occasionally a side of mutton, but we had to cook it all ourselves. But still, it was all experience. And, of course, I went on with my fishing. I might say that when I was at Nazaria, my brother sent me out some eel hooks, and they used to solder them to D5 cable, very wide, very fine line, and sling them out at between 10 o'clock and midnight, in moonlight. And we used to, three of us, we used to catch large fish, which we called rock salmon. They were really monsters. Anything of about 4 to 6 pounds each. But only one in every three was a fish. The other two were turtles, which we had to hack off the line and throw out again, and they used to tangle the line up. But when we brought the fish back, the camp was glad of them for breakfast. So we were an asset there. But anyhow, I resumed my fishing again at Hidley Barrows, but in the locks. But it wasn't so successful. We used to see the big salmon trying to jump the herring, trying to jump the barrows, and the herringers put nets underneath, so if they missed, they fell back in the net. I saw one salmon being pushed along to the officer's mess on a donkey, and his head was on one side, on nearly on the ground, and its tail on the other. Huge thing. What do you think, about 2 foot wide? Oh, there was some wonderful fish there. Now, at India Barrage, I was in touch with Hiller, a place called Kabbalah, out in the desert, a place called Masaib, on one of the canals, and a place called Kufa. Now, Kufa is on the caravan route, and the caravan route to Damascus. And beyond Kufa, about 10 miles, is a holy city called Najaf, with a reputed golden dome. From Kufa, you could see the dome shining on the horizon. Well, Arab vandals, or what would you call them, anyhow, bad lot, there were robbing the caravansaries going to Damascus, so they had to be stopped. And the first four Somersets surrounded the place, starved them out, and brought in 12 of them to Hiller. They brought them in just before I went to Hinder Barrows, and they were sentenced to be hung. I was at India Barrows when the execution took place, and the 12 were lined up, I'm told, out in the square, and they watched their pals being hung one by one. It was a terrible sight, I'm told, but I wasn't there. I went to see my chums who had been transferred to the first four Somersets. Now, we as a battalion had green putty tops, black buttons, and green round our puggeries. We were supposed to be a rifle regiment. The other regulars had their yellow poly tops, yellow round, and shiny brass button. But I went into the Sets camp looking for them. A chap told me approximately where they were, and they were in tents with the flies rolled up. Therefore, I stood outside one tent, and a very dear old voice said, "Who's that silly so-and-so still got his green puppy tops on?" So I looked inside, and there were some full of my old pals. It was a very sweet meeting. Also, I forgot to mention, when I was at Nazareth, an old school pal of mine, Smart Smith, was in a wireless section, the first wireless section that had come out to Mishpat, and they were stationed at Nazareth. And I went to see him there because I knew he was on my way from the office back to the camp. And I went to see him there, and he came to see me, and he told me all the news. He told me about Mum, and he told me about all Mum's friends. And eventually, when we did get home, he was my best man. Nice chap. Now, where were we? Oh, it's Hiller. Well, after being at Hiller for a while, it got so obvious that the Turks were being nicked. They were pushed further north, well away from Baghdad. So, in the meantime, while we were at Hiller and the outstations, where we had marched, a railway was being built from Baghdad, Hidaidi West Bank, to Hiller. And that railway was completed by the time we decided to retreat, as it were, from Hiller to Baghdad. That was in 1918. And we went back by rail. Open land, of course, but we went back to Baghdad by rail. And we got back just in time for the Turkish Armistice Day, which packed up on the day they joined, the 5th of November. Oh, 5 years, 4 years afterwards, wasn't it? Well, there was the very first large aeroplane to come to Mishpat had arrived just a day or two before. A Handley Page bomber, and it zoomed over Baghdad and cowed all the Arabs and everybody. Oh, it was a wonderful sight. It zoomed just over the flat rooftops, and it impressed us a lot. Well, after that, we went into camp, was sort of waiting, didn't know quite what to do, and then some of us volunteered to go to the Dunster Force. Now, the Dunster Force was an anti-Soviet force. The Soviets were in danger, or the Russians rather they were called then, were in danger of capturing the oil wells of Batum on the Caspian Sea. And we were to forestall them capturing those oil wells. So we sent a force up there, and we had to supply that force. And we had to send petrol up to protect the oil wells. And we had to send supplies out. Now, I was put out, or our little band of about six of us, from putting in khaki, stewing in heat. We went to the frontier, the Persian frontier, and we were fitted out with serge and fleece-lined pants and balaclava helmets and scarves and woolen vests. Oh, we were fitted out like an Arctic expedition, because, you see, it was November, and it was winter in Persia. And we went from Kaiser Sharin on the frontier through Karind to a place called Kermanshah. And there were four the back axle units of four cars. One station, they were the cards, hearts, spades, clubs, diamonds, ours was the clubs. and the clubs were stationed at Kermanshaw. Their duty was to bring up supplies from Corinne and take them to a place called Kangavore and maintain supplies. We signallers were attached to them, and our duties were to bring up the mail and dispatches, and we were allocated a Ford car for that. Oh, the weather was atrocious. When they started the cars in the morning, they used to jack them up and have a machine to turn the back wheel to start the engine. Oh, it was terrible, a little cold out there, and the snow. When we used to go up hills, we used to go turn the car around and go up in reverse, because it was the lowest gear in the car. They used to bring up the camels. Convoys used to bring up 50 gallons per camel in 10-gallon drums. No, 100 gallons. 5 drums on each side of the camel's back to supply the troops further up nearer the Caspian. And my job used to be either to go down to Corinne with to collect dispatches there, or go up to Kangaroo the other way. How much longer have I got?
Quite a lot. Go on.
So, that was a very interesting job. I liked it. I used to take photographs, because then, when we were at Hiller, no, when we were at Nazaria, the Batman used to bring up supplies of films for us. Of course, my film soon expired, but I had a VPK then. It was most economic. I swapped it for a primer stove when I ran out of films. Then, where am I? Oh, Kermanshaw. Then we stuck at Kermanshaw doing these jobs. Now, at one place was rather interesting. When we had if the weather was bad, it took us 2 days to get to Corinne, and we used to stop at a place called Faranabad, halfway, and camp in a little tent they provided for us there, our one Ford car. And once when I was there, on the hillside was an Indian battalion, and an Indian orderly came running down the hillside to me, about a mile or more. Jeremy Saab, Tamora Sabadar, Karegib, hi, he wants me to go and see you. I thought, devil does he want me to go and see him for? I was feeling rather unregenerate those days. Anyhow, I mooched up the hill, and outside his tent, there he was, squatted like there. I didn't even salute him. I said, yes, sir. I'm to tell you, do not eat meat. The destiny tells me you are not to eat meat. Will you remember that? I said, yeah. Thank you. You may go. And that's all I got from him. Which was rather remarkable, considering he was a mile and a half away from me when he sent for me. Well, eventually, the applications for DMOB whom our various firms in England came through, and I had a priority because I was on a priority trade, hospital service, and it came through for me to Baghdad. So back I went to Baghdad, and then by paddle steamer I went down the Tigris again to Basra, and there we were sorted out. A long time at Basra, it seemed, a week or so. It seemed years when you knew you were going home, and then you were paid out all your arrears at Baghdad. No, you paid out at Dulani. Well, from Baghdad we went by steamer back to Bombay, and by Bombay to a place called Dulali. Dulali was the demobilization center then. And there we were paid our arrears, and I met some of my old chums in Dulali. And one or two of them came home via Baghdad, via Bombay, on the same steamer, the Elias, 7,500 tons, very small boat. And we did the return trip through the Mediterranean, over with a difference in the canal. For when we went out there, there was nothing on the east side. When we came back, there were camps and stores. Oh, very impressive. The wartime had made a great difference in the canal. Then we got home to Liverpool. And from Liverpool to Crystal Palace for demobilization. And at Crystal Palace on the morning I went home, at 8 o'clock in the morning, I went to a public telephone box and I called Kingston 0463. And my old dad answered. He said, "Hello." I said, "This is Archie." Oh dear, it was the excitement of it all. And I got home, I think it was the 13th of June, 1919. There's one or two things I'd forgotten, and I'll add them as the tape allows. I had dysentery, rather badly, just before we had our signal test, and so badly that I had to camp outside the toilet for one night. Now, one of the little things we did on the Murray Hills as a pastime, five or six of us took advantage of Indian ponies, mountain ponies. They used to wait at the gate to see if anybody wanted a ride, and they used to charge us 8 annas an hour. That would be about 8 pence to use their ponies, and we used to ride them up the hill to Garry Hall, which is on the road to Srinagar, past Murray, which is the headquarters of the 2nd North Staffs Hill Station, a distance of about 8 miles, and a slight rise up, and we used to gallop like a hill coming back. Anyhow, it taught us to ride, so much so that one day, four of us did a journey back 20 miles towards Rawalpindi, Tret, a place called Tret, and back again. Anyhow, it gave us so much experience. Anyhow, this is the reason I'm telling you that. When I was in the RVs at Nazarene, the corporal in charge of the mule lines was from the 21st Lancers, and he was in charge of a riding school. We as REs all had to learn to ride, and we had to learn not with saddles but with blankets secured round the horse. And didn't they fall off? Fortunately, I did not, because I'd had the engine experience. Now I'll tell you another funny story. When I was up in Kermanshire in the cold, once a week we had an issue of rum. By the way, rum was part of the supplies that went up, and each car in the convoy had a pack hall, a water pack hall for cooling their radiator. Not that they wanted it, there's plenty of snow about. But anyhow, those water pack halls caused a lot of inebriation on the way, and when we arrived home, methinks that the spirit of the rum had got into the water hose. Well, anyhow, once a week we had a ration, and we all filed round, and the sergeant major had a Dixie and a little ladle, and we came with our mugs, and he poured a little drop in. I went round the first time and got my ration, and I thought, this is easy. So I went round the second time, and when I come to him, he looked at her. He said, "Do you think I fell over Christmas tree?" I said, "Why?" He says, "You got your putty tops down from the bottom upwards." That was the RE fashion. He counted us. Let me see, just a little from him. If I'm going to tell you about the Charwaller and the Dobiewaller. The Dobiewaller was a laundryman, and one of his methods was to go down to a shingly stream and bash our clothes on the shore. And that didn't do them any good, and it knocked off the buttons, the trousers buttons. And then they had the dersey, the tailor, and you had to send your clothes to them to put new buttons on. It was a sort of the wangle. So I sent home to my mother, and she sent me out some bachelor's buttons. Do you know what bachelor's buttons are? Bachelor's buttons are like studs. Clips, one clip through the other. Well, they were trousers buttons clipped on. She sent me out about 100. And I fitted all my trousers with bachelor's buttons. Long trousers for guard, short trousers for work, and what I didn't have, I gave away to my pals. Now, that was the day we... No, now the Charwaller. The Charwaller used to come round every day, twice a day, and sell us extra tea. And he used to charge us this. Half a mugful was half an anna. That is two pice. Dough meaning two. And biscuits were six for an anna, and three for dough pice. So, mark you, our money was very small. And some wags used to say, "Don't price, Char, Go price biscuit and soft quote piano. Now what does that mean? A halfpence of tea, a halfpence of biscuits, and clean the mug. And then some of them used to put it on the book. Instead of paying for it, put it on the book, and the child, when I used to come round once a week with his book. And some of them used to twist him, and his moan was, "All men take it char, no man give it price. Some man must be the lie." One chap, who was as honest as the day is long, a bit of a wag, signed his name. He came to this door, the one I came to me and said, "You like this name? Lord Twistle." And I said, "Yes, Borisov, the tall man." "Oh, he Borisov." So there you are. We got thinking in pidgin Hindustani in those days, and it all comes back to me now. Go on, twist off a bit. Very interested in our signalling to Murray Hill, 33 miles away. We had a high power telescope, and well, we had the ordinary telescope with a high power lens, which we used to screw in the end. On a tripod, I used to see the flash of the helio during the day. But the heat wave was in between us and Murray, and the high power lens exaggerated the heat wave, so it was all a shimmer. And we found the easiest way was for them to signal by large flag, and we could read it through the high power scope. Then the lamps at night time, they used to signal by lamps, and we could read that easily on the high power scope. Oh, there were a lot of interesting things that we knew. When we were passing out for our tests in RE, they taught us a lot of elementary electronics, and we were also taught some by the telegraphists. There was a telegraph line, as I told you, from Basra, from Baghdad to Hilla, and one end of our signal office was with the post office telegraphists with their sounders, and chattering away, and then any message that came through for us signals was the other end of the office. And they used to tell us a lot of electronics, and they told me how I absolutely upset the line, and how our captain apologised to them for what I'd done. I'm telling you.